the headlines, the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad visits the United Arab Emirates in his first such travel to an Arab state since the beginning of the Syrian war in 2011. Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky calls for comprehensive security talks with Moscow as Russia, lead negotiator, says ceasefire talks are making progress. And Britain bans Russia Today from broadcasting in the United Kingdom over Moscow's military offensive in Ukraine. Move has provoked criticism by media observers. Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to World News. The United Arab Emirates says that Syria's fundamental pillar of Arab security as the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad visits the Persian Gulf country. Abu Dhabi's Crown Prince says Emirate is keen to strengthen cooperation with Damascus. Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan made the comments in a meeting with Assad. The Syrian president also held talks with Dubai's ruler, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum. They emphasize the need to protect the territorial integrity of Syria and the withdrawal of foreign forces from the country. Assad's visit is the first to an Arab country since the beginning of the war in Syria back in 2011. And back in 2018, the UAE also reopened its embassy in Damascus and called for Syria's return to the Arab League. Earlier, our correspondent in Syria, Muhammad Ali, gave us the details on the Syrian president's visit to the Emirates.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad visited the United Arab Emirates. He was welcomed there, and he met with the Vice President, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum. Then Syrian President Bashar al-Assad also met with the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi, Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan, who also welcomed the Syrian President there in Abu Dhabi, and said that this visit comes in the framework of perhaps joint keenness on continuing consultation and coordination between the two countries on various issues, regional issues and international issues. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad also said that the UAE plays a very important role, taking into consideration balanced policies that it adopts towards international issues. Also, President Bashar al-Assad pointed out that the world is changing and is heading in the direction of instability, and thus, President Assad went on to say, in order to protect our region, we must continue to adhere to our principles, to the sovereignty of our countries, and the interests of our people.
Earlier, we were joined by human rights activist Firas al-Najim to get his thoughts on the Syrian president's visit to the United Arab Emirates.
This just shows that Bashar Assad has been victorious, with this big battle that's happening against him, and so many countries are involved in this, including the UAE, and they failed miserably in this battle against Bashar al-Assad. Now they have submitted to the reality is that Bashar al-Assad has a strong support base inside Syria, and that he was able to resist and fight all these Takfiri groups, all these terrorist groups, and all this Western engineering to get him out of power, because obviously he's supportive of the resistance in the area, and he's a key ally to the Islamic Republic of Iran. So the UAE cannot be trusted in any way. You know, they're a puppet regime. They're serving the U.S. interest. Now they're serving, obviously, now more the Israeli interest because they're getting deeper in this hole that they put themselves in. And I'm pretty sure that, he's a very wise man, Bashar al-Assad, so he's taking all that into consideration as well when he's dealing with them. And I'm pretty sure he's conveying to them the message of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the allies and their experience in this 11-year-old war.
British-Iranians Nazanin Zaghari Radcliffe and Anousheh Ashouri are back in the United Kingdom from Iran after serving a portion of their sentences on charges of espionage. News of their release has been accompanied by rampant speculation about the timing of the repayment of a £400 million decades-old debt to the Islamic Republic by the British. Now, Tehran denies any links between the two events, as Amina Taylor reports from the British capital.
Their return to British soil, like their period of incarceration, a media event of the highest order. British Iranians Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe and Anousheh Shouri touched down at Bryce Norton Air Base in the early hours of Thursday morning. Both had been jailed on espionage charges in Iran. Their release comes after months of delicate negotiations and culminated in their freedom, according to a statement from Iran's foreign ministry, on the basis of Islamic leniency and humanitarian considerations. In what has become a media firestorm, much has been made of Britain's repayment of a historic debt to the Islamic Republic.
The Islamic Republic has consistently rejected any links between London's repayment of a decades-old debt and the release of the British Iranian nationals, despite attempts in Western mainstream media reporting to conflate the two issues.
We received the money a few days ago, but simultaneously the judicial process for the release of these two persons was going on. Maybe chronologically, their release and the deposit of the money were close, but there is no connection between these two issues.
UK Foreign Secretary Liz Truss had previously spoken of making the repayment of Iranian debt a priority.
I've also been very clear that the debt that we owe Iran is legitimate, and we are seeking ways to pay that.
The release of the two dual nationals is the culmination of years of talks between London and Tehran, including a political revelation by then Foreign Secretary, now MP Boris Johnson, that Zaghari Ratcliffe was not a charity worker, as was widely stated.
He admitted, didn't he, at the dispatch box that she was employed by Reuters in training journalists. And as I've said, that is a classic tactic that's used to, develop assets in nations that you know, Britain has hostilities towards. So, in that sense, I think, he let the cat out of the bag. And obviously we know now that, an agreement's been reached and she's been released. But, I think that did reveal that there was a lot more to this situation than we were being told by the corporate media in this country.
Both Zaghari Ratcliffe and her employer, the Thomson Reuters Foundation, had maintained she was simply visiting family while on vacation. A third person, Murat Abbas, has also been released but remains in Iran for the time being. Amina Taylor, London.
The Ukrainian president has called for meaningful peace and security talks with Russia to end the ongoing conflict in his country.
We were always insisting on the negotiations. We were always offering dialogue, offering a solution for peace, not only during the 23 days of invasion. And I want everyone to hear me now, especially in Moscow. The time has come for a meeting. It is time to talk.
Vladimir Zelensky says that this is Russia's only chance to reduce harm from its own mistakes. He warned Russia that pushing its campaign means that it will need generations to recover from losses suffered during the war. Zelensky added that the time has come to restore the territorial integrity of Ukraine. He also accused Russian forces of blocking the supply of humanitarian aid to Ukrainian cities. Kiev and Moscow have held several rounds of talks on a ceasefire. Russia's lead negotiator earlier said talks are making progress on Ukraine's demilitarization. He said, however, Moscow's demand for denazification of Ukraine has yet to be met. Presidents of China and the U.S. have discussed the war in Ukraine in a virtual meeting with the Chinese leader, calling for dialogue to resolve the crisis. Xi Jinping said the U.S. and NATO should recognize security concerns of Moscow and Kiev. She also criticized Western sanctions against Russia. He said the measures could trigger serious crises worldwide. She added war needs to end as soon as possible. The U.S. president also backed a diplomatic solution in Ukraine. However, he warned China of consequences if it provides material support to Russia's military campaign. Earlier, China and Russia rejected the U.S. claim that they discussed the supply of military equipment for Russian forces in the conflict. Political commentator Sarah Flounders believes that the U.S. has sabotaged efforts to resolve tensions between Ukraine and Russia diplomatically.
I think the U.S. has been completely against any form of dialogue and has sabotaged every effort at a diplomatic solution. They have pumped billions and billions of dollars of lethal weapons, heavy weapons, nuclear-capable weapons into the Ukraine, right on the Russian border. They have been firing into eastern Ukraine right on the Russian border for 8 years. 14,000 people have died in these the attacks coming from the Ukrainian government, all funded by the United States and by NATO. So rather than in any way pull back on this, instead, you have discussions of a no-fly zone. I mean, that's a real nuclear threat. You have sending in heavier and heavier weapons through Poland, Hungary, so on, the surrounding countries, right again on Russia's border. So I think the United States has to, Biden administration has to show some willingness to have negotiations to stop the funding of these forces and the sending of U.S. troops.
British media regulator Ofcom has banned Russia Today from broadcasting in the U.K. over Moscow's military offensive in Ukraine. Media observers have slammed the move as anti-democratic and an attack on the freedom of speech and the press. London correspondent Saeed Puriza reports.
It's now official. Russia's English-language state broadcaster RT stripped of its broadcasting license in the U.K.
The decision was made by media regulator Ofcom that said it does not consider RT, with studios in the building behind me, fit and proper to hold a UK license, and that it cannot be satisfied that RT can be a responsible broadcaster.
To some, the move that followed weeks of rising tensions between Russia and the West over the Ukraine crisis was long overdue. To others, censorship, pure and simple. Journalist Afshin Watansi is the host of the broadcaster's flagship program, Going Underground.
We've been in this situation together when they banned Press TV, Iran's program. I worked for Press TV. They banned that. They banned CGTN, the Chinese television company. Now they're banning RT. It just shows how much Britain is on the wrong side of history. It is the end of press freedom, the end completely, to me, it seems, like of informed consent, as in democracy. You can't have democracy without informed consent, and the British people can no longer watch programs that dissent from the prevailing narrative fed to us by the BBC and others.
The decision has also called into question Ofcom's independence. RT Deputy Editor-in-Chief Anna Belkina accused the regulator of being nothing more than a tool of the government.
I don't like censorship of any kind. I very much believe in freedom of speech. With freedom of speech comes responsibility, which is why we have Ofcom as a regulator. But if Ofcom is going to become an extension of the government peddling out that particular government style of propaganda, we are indeed entering into very dangerous territory.
As RT falls victim to unmitigated hostility towards Russia over Ukraine, media consumers here in the UK lose an important source that's brought them the other side of so many stories for so many years. Saeed Puriza, London.
The UN World Food Program is warning the European countries and the U.S. against ignoring global crises beyond Ukraine. Now, director of the agency said neglecting those crises could lead to catastrophic consequences. David Beasley says rising hunger could cause mass migration and fuel further instability in poor countries. This comes after the UN warned Russia's military campaign in Ukraine could aggravate hunger crisis in countries such as Yemen and Ethiopia. Ukraine is one of the largest grain exporters on the planet. A U.S. military aircraft with four people on board has crashed in northern Norway. Incident took place during a NATO military exercise. Fate of the passengers of the V-22 Osprey is still unknown. The Norwegian military says the plane was caught in bad weather and hit the ground. Search and rescue teams are looking for missing passengers. Currently, 3,000 U.S. Marines are taking part in war games in northern Norway. Drills were staged amid rising tensions between Russia and NATO over Ukraine. Now, people across Afghanistan are celebrating the birth anniversary of Imam Mahdi, the 12th Shia Imam. They also called for Islamic Brotherhood and solidarity among all Muslims. Rahmatullah Baghban reports from Kabul.
Mehdi Shaban is one of Muslims' great eats. marking the birth anniversary of Imam Mahdi, the 12th Shia Imam. Afghans gathered here at Sahih Shrine in Kabul to pay tribute to their last Imam and celebrate the occasion.
I congratulate Afghans and other Muslims on the birth anniversary of Imam Mahdi. This is a joyous Eid for us and we have come here to celebrate it. Prophet Muhammad has promised the advent of Mahdi and we are eagerly waiting for that day. May he come and fill the world with justice and peace.
Fortunately, here everything looks great. People are happy celebrating Mid Shaban. As an Afghan, I mark the birth anniversary of Mid Shaban every year, but today it's different. More families have come here since the security threats are gone.
Kabul residents decorate the Sahih Shrine and hold traditional ceremonies, announcing their allegiance to Imam Mahdi. They also take the occasion as a chance for highlighting Islamic solidarity among Muslims. At the same time, the Taliban say they will tighten the security during the Eid.
God willing, we have tightened security everywhere. We are serving all people of Afghanistan and don't let anything or anyone threaten them. Today, people can mark their occasions without trouble.
People in Afghanistan have been struggling with poverty and hunger crisis. In the meantime, they don't miss any chance to mark cultural occasions and to spread Islamic bliss. People have come here for the love of their last Imam, Hazrat Mahdi. They observe Mid Shaban as a great Eid and hold such ceremonies every year. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
And that's it for your latest. Thanks for tuning in and goodbye for now.
New Year, Nowruz is almost here.
Join iRabbi English Radio on Sunday afternoon, 20th of March at 1500 hours GMT as we chime in the new year at 1533 GMT.
We celebrate Nowruz live on air on Sunday afternoon, March 20th, 2022, around the traditional half-seen table.
We wish you a wonderful and prosperous Nowruz.
Limelight.
Biden administration's program to facilitate access to antivirals will have a limited impact because American pharmacists are restricted from prescribing the pills. Stay with us for an article written by Benjamin Ryan under the heading Test to Treat. Pharmacists say Biden's major new COVID initiative won't work. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Major pharmacist groups argue a major new Biden administration initiative to facilitate access to COVID-19 antivirals will have a limited impact and fail to mitigate certain health inequities because pharmacists are restricted from prescribing the pills. Announced in President Biden's State of the Union address, the Test to Treat program is meant to address the maddening difficulty Americans have had in accessing COVID-19 treatments. The administration will channel newly increasing stocks of antiviral pills to major retail pharmacies that have in-house clinics, providing one-step testing and antivirals access. The program, which the administration aims to purportedly provide for free in the face of fierce Republican opposition to new COVID-19 spending, is also slated to roll out in Veterans Affairs clinics, community health centers, and long-term care facilities. Major participants include some 250 Walgreens stores, 225 Kroger Little Clinics, and 1,200 CVS Minute Clinics. CVS clinics in particular are staffed by nurse practitioners and physician assistants authorized by the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, to prescribe the two currently available COVID antivirals, Pfizer's Paxlovid and Merck and Ridgeback Biotherapeutics' Molnupiravir. In a 9th of March letter to Biden calling for pharmacists to be granted authority to prescribe these pills, 14 organizations representing pharmacies and pharmacists insisted Test to Treat's impact will be compromised by the fact that such in-house clinics are relatively limited in number and largely in urban areas. The letter states, "Unfortunately, rural and underserved communities are less likely to benefit from your test-to-treat approach because of this limitation." According to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, 90% of Americans live within 5 miles of one of approximately 60,000 pharmacies. Michael Ganio, a Columbus, Ohio pharmacist, senior director of pharmacy practice and quality at the American Society of Health System Pharmacists, which is a signatory of the letter to President Biden, said, "The FDA is still blocking us from leveraging the most accessible healthcare provider out there to make sure that these patients can get these drugs easily." Michael Ganio said, "As far as expanding access, Test to Treat is not doing a lot. The need for COVID-19 antivirals is likely to be greater in rural areas, at least on a per capita basis." A recent CDC study found that through January, 58.5% of people aged 5 and older in rural counties had received at least one coronavirus vaccination shot, compared with 75.4% in urban counties. Paxlovid and Molnupiravir are authorized for individuals at high risk of severe COVID-19, in particular unvaccinated people with certain medical conditions. Paxlovid was 88% effective at preventing hospitalization and death in its clinical trial. Molnupiravir proved just 30% effective. The FDA only authorizes its use when other treatments are unavailable or aren't advised for an individual. sufficient supply of Paxlovid will be key to test to treat. Since late December, the federal government has delivered a woefully inadequate 700,000 Paxlovid courses to states. The biweekly allotment increasing from 100,000 in January to 175,000 in March. The Biden administration has claimed it will distribute 1 million courses in March and 2.5 million courses in April. A Pfizer representative would only state that the company plans to deliver a cumulative 10 million courses by the end of June. The administration has agreed to purchase 20 million courses slated to be delivered by the end of September. In September of 2021, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services amended a federal public health emergency law, the PrEP Act, to grant licensed pharmacists the authority to order and administer select COVID-19 therapeutics, which at the time meant monoclonal antibodies and vaccines. But when the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, authorized Paxlovid and Molnupiravir in December, it explicitly restricted pharmacists from prescribing them. Authors of the letter to President Biden say they submitted data to the FDA at the end of January, hoping to persuade it to grant pharmacists prescribing authority. These groups have also lobbied the federal government to ensure Medicare Part B would reimburse pharmacists for such prescribing, a move that would probably lead health insurers to follow. Prescribing Paxlovid safely can be challenging because it may interact harmfully with other medications. Additionally, the FDA advises against providing the treatment to those with severe kidney or liver impairment. Experts have also raised concerns about molnupiravir's potential toxicities. It cannot be prescribed to minors and is not advised for pregnant women. Chanapa Tanti Banchachai, an FDA press officer, said the agency's decision to forbid pharmacists from prescribing Paxlovid and molnupiravir was based on several factors, including the drug's side effect profiles, the need to assess potential for drug interactions, the need to assess potential kidney function problems, including the severity of potential problems, and the need to evaluate patients for pre-existing conditions linked to severe COVID-19. Tanti Banchachai said the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, could revise the policy as new data and new information become available. On 4th of March, the American Medical Association said the pharmacy-based clinic component of the test-to-treat plan flaunts patient safety and risks significant negative health outcomes. The American Medical Association, AMA, argued that by prescribing COVID antivirals at such clinics, providers may endanger patients for whom they lack a comprehensive medical history. The pharmacy groups insisted in their letter to President Biden that they have the expertise to prescribe these medications. In an email to The Guardian, Al Carter, executive director of the National Association of Boards of Pharmacy, stated, "Pharmacists have more complete access to the patient's medication in comparison to physicians, especially since most patients have more than one prescriber who don't necessarily talk with each other," adding, "Pharmacists spend their whole education focused on medications and their impacts on the body, whereas physicians take the minimal number of classes on pharmacology." Catherine Yang, a clinical pharmacist at the University of California, San Francisco, said, "There are a lot of studies that show that when you increase services in community pharmacies, you improve healthcare. In a lot of neighborhoods and rural areas, people may not have access to primary care, and pharmacists are the most accessible public health provider the patients can see."
Back to reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, sisters and brothers, ladies and gentlemen from every single corner of the world, wherever you are, welcome to your program. This is Arab English Radio. You're hearing me from Back to Reality. Spring is just around the corner, and where we live, everything smells like spring is just knocking the door. The nature is changing its claws and everything is turning new. There are very much of beautiful blossoms on the trees, and it shows that spring is very close to us. Just like this story that happens to the nature. Where we live, spring marks the beginning of the new year, and hereby I officially say Happy New Year to everyone and all those nations and people whose new year starts with the spring, which is one of the best seasons in the life. So, just as this story that we were talking about, the change of situations is in nature, we have the same thing in ourselves. I am your humble host, Asma, and here with me I have two very dear guests, Brother Hassanain and Brother Sayyid Jaffa.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Very pleased to meet you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you for having us. Thank you for being here. Now, as everyone talks about New Year, something comes to our mind, which is the resolutions that come at the day of the New Year. It's actually very difficult to change ourselves. Most of the times we decide to change a specific habit in ourselves just by the coming of the new year, but that turns out to be a little bit of difficult and tricky. We cannot cope up with it during the year. Has it ever happened to you to have to make a resolution at the evening of the new year and then forget about it the entire year? Well, it has happened to me.
Frankly speaking, I don't really make resolutions. You know, I have got plans for days, but not for years. So, you know, I believe in that. You know, people say that.
I'm like that too. Days are better than years.
Yeah, like people say that, you know, new year, new me.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what happens is they make a big resolution, a good resolution, like, you know, amazing stuff to do. But, you know, that's just for a week or two.
Yeah, that's just a slogan, I think.
Yeah.
Everybody says it, but know, no one does it.
They follow it just for a week or two, then you can see it lying down somewhere. But what you should do is, like, you should have a plan for, you know, a day you can plan for months. Like, making a resolution is just a formality. You know,
yes.
if you actually want to make a resolution, you should also turn it into actions.
Exactly.
That's what I believe. So you should be committed with your resolution.
I don't really set a resolution that... Because typically a resolution is something that you haven't done yet or you've, mm-hmm. say, let go for a while and you want to restart it. In a sense, what I do is I plan for the next year, like what things I can get done. But I wouldn't really call it a resolution to the sense because it's become, at least in the U.S., it's become a trend of just saying, oh, look, I'm going to get into shape. I'm going to, say, do better in school. I'm going to get a promotion at work. Like very superficial things that for the most part aren't really in your hands. And what ends up happening is you're really focused for like the first week, maybe 2 weeks, really pushing it, maybe a month.
And then everything.
And then everything just falls apart
yeah.
there.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I wanted to say that, you know, it's become a trend, like formality in the sense mm-hmm. it's become a trend. Like you have certain goals you have to
exactly.
achieve. You just write it down on a paper.
Mm-hmm.
Then you say that I have to achieve these goals, like, you know, accomplish these goals.
But, you know, the urge for resolution comes from the ambition that we have to change, right?
Yeah.
What is important is changing, which we could do
exactly.
On a daily basis.
Exactly.
We should have goals. Wait for a year, yes.
Yeah, we should have goals. We should have, you know, goals set, like, I want to achieve this and that. And just the thing is, like, we are acquiring a change
mm-hmm.
and we have to turn our goals,
exactly.
our dreams into actions.
So right now, let's go for a little break and we'll be back after just a short interval. Thank you for listening, us.
Please
please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir. I would love to change, but how to start it? You know, the steps are very difficult because you talked about action, you know?
The first step is, you know, start with the small things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, the small things you just want to get rid of.
Yeah.
You know, start with them. You know, just don't jump for big goals.
Yes, just like eating chunk by chunk, little.
Like drops and drops make the river.
Small bits, yes.
Yeah.
Most psychologists also say that when you want to make a big change in your life, you want to start off with small goals and achieve those goals so you don't, say, diminish that drive you have to reach something new.
Yes.
Right? You want small little victories that push you towards that direction.
Exactly.
Instead of taking a big leap and, say, missing it.
And when you see it like it's a very big thing to do, then you would stop going into it. You would be scared.
Yeah, you get hesitant and you drop the idea.
Yes, that's a story.
That actually makes you demotivated.
Mm-hmm.
If you set a big goal and you face some problems in accomplishing that, you actually get demotivated.
Exactly.
But if you start step by step, you know, it won't be difficult for you to reach the step on the top.
Yes.
Like you climb just step by step.
What's another point to let it go like this?
One thing I could say is instead of just doing it on your own, you do it with a couple of people. Say you slip up one day, there's someone there to help you out.
To remind
you. To keep you in check, to remind you, look, this is the goal at the end. This is what we're trying to achieve.
Yes.
And look, I get it. It gets tough here and there, but, you know, you keep each other towards that goal.
I think in the process of changing, continuity is very important.
Yeah.
To really stick to the goal you have.
Yeah.
It's true that it's going to be something like a big change in your habits or in your characteristics, whatever that you're going to change. But if you go for it like every single day, every moment in your life, then it would turn into a habit. Then after a while, you don't need to even try because it's been a part of you, right?
Yeah. You need to challenge yourself. Like, this is your goal and you need to challenge yourself that I have to do this. In any way, I have to do this.
If there is a bad habit inside of me and I want to change it, do you think it's possible to erase it all?
Yeah, of course. Like, you know, if someone's, you know...
Does it happen?
Yeah, it happens. Okay, so I'll tell my personal experience. I was kind of obese before.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, one fine day, I made a goal that I have to start dieting and working out. So, you know, I'll eat less.
So you have done it well.
Yeah,
then.
So... But I started eating less. So this might be counted as, you know, a bad habit, eating more.
Yes, yes.
I'm kind of foodie guy. I plan
Who is
that,
not?
Yeah. So I plan that I'll eat less.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I started working out.
And it became a habit in you, right?
Yeah, yeah. What do I mean by like 3-4 times before I actually started? I started and I skipped.
Mm-hmm.
Then again, I started and then I skipped. But one fine day when I actually challenged myself and I committed to that goal, that day I was able to take it to the end.
I don't have a personal experience like Brother Hussein, but from what I understood here is, look, you want to challenge yourself, but you don't want to be too strict on yourself either, right? Because
yes,
if you're too hard on yourself, then you're going to eventually lose the habit without it becoming an everyday thing to you. Exactly. You'll get frustrated and you'll stop.
Yes.
Right?
Just like studying what we had at the schools. When we had too much of hardships and when we had to force ourselves into studying...
You give up immediately.
Yes.
Again, like I want to go back to that. You got to make like small little goals to get you in that direction.
Yes.
That it slowly becomes a habit. Because most people, they want to try to do a lot of things in a small amount of time, which isn't possible for most people.
Exactly.
They break apart. They can't keep it going. The consistency goes away.
Exactly. The consistency is very important. And as I said before, we have to do it in a way that it becomes a habit.
So as we were talking about, you know, small chunks and, you know, moving forward step by step, if we need to give an example and making something as our goal, a good goal, I might say, like if you plan, and we all should have this goal, that you'll start reading Nahjul Balagha.
Exactly.
The book of Imam Ali. So over here, Nahjul Balagha, you know, it's a big book.
Yes.
Once, you know, someone, you know, if someone wants to read that, you know, first of all, reader, like, you know, he doesn't like reading much. But what you can do is, what I, even I have done sometimes is, before you sleep, you just read one page.
Yes.
Before you sleep. Like, similarly...
Make it an obligation that every day or every night, just
and
one...
And reading page, I don't think make... it'll take more than 5 minutes.
Exactly. Just like reading the Quran, the holy book. A year comes and goes. We don't perhaps have time to go for it and read it. But when the holy month comes, we see that we could finish it in only a month. And it does not take that much of time from us. So we just regret the days and the moments we've passed without doing such good things in our lives.
Like, because, you know, if you start that way, in just 14 weeks, you have just finished like 100 pages.
Exactly.
So what happens now, when, once you start reading Nahjul Balagha and you make it your habit, like one page a week, that becomes your habit.
Exactly.
Even if you want to discontinue, you'll feel restless. You cannot sleep without reading it.
Exactly.
Because that has become a part of your life. It has become your habit.
That is very true.
You have to do that.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
But what happens if, say, you want to start and you do it a couple days, but then something comes up and you can't read one night?
Doesn't matter. Just try to read it the next
day. The next day, yeah. Okay.
So, and what happens
make
is...
Make up for it.
Exactly. Because one issue that happens is some people try to be really consistent. And if they get a couple of days here and there that say they don't get to read it.
A very good point you popped out.
They get very discouraged. They try to leave it. They're like, oh, no, now I have to make up, say 5 pages, say 10 pages. But the problem here is that they've made the benchmark so hard for themselves.
Exactly.
Where they start doubting if they can continue at all, right? So say, like Brother Hussain said, brought up a good point. You start off with, say, even if you're not a reader, if one page is also too much, you
start
off with
one page.
Half a page. You start with one paragraph, right? You just try to get the car rolling, right?
Yeah,
exactly.
I believe that one page is... it won't be a problem for anyone. You know, even someone's, he's not any reader. He doesn't like reading books, but he wants to read any book. He can read one page a day.
But what Brother Jafar said is very true. You know, it has happened to me many times. I start doing something and then after a week or two, something happens, there's a break and it's cut off.
Yeah, for that, what we need to do is like, if you really make it your goal, if you really want to achieve that goal, what you do is, like, even if it's not your habit, you start by small steps, like reading one page a day. That's not an issue for anyone. One fine day, if you cannot do it for so-and-so reasons, you just do it the next day. But you do it until it becomes your habit.
Exactly.
It will become your habit.
And if there was a pause, it's no problem. You can start again.
Yeah.
Small chunks and you go for it again and again and again.
Yeah, and I'm sure like Nahjul Balagha is a kind of book that, you know, after a few weeks you just shift from one page to like 2 or 3 pages.
Yeah, you increase the amount depending on how much you can take. Right?
Yeah.
In the beginning, obviously, you want to keep it small to an amount where you can consistently read it. Right?
Yeah.
After a while, you're going to get sucked into the book.
Yeah.
Right? A good book always has that factor, right? It always sucks you in.
Exactly.
And one page turns into 10 pages, turns into, say, half the book, say, the whole book. You just sit there and you're doing the whole book in one sitting. So in that aspect, it's don't try to keep really hard, strict goals for yourself and try to keep it consistent.
That's the gist. Don't make it so hard and go slow and slow. Thank you very much. I guess this is the entire time we have got for this session. Thank you for listening to us. We were talking to you from IRB English Radio, and this is Back to Reality. We talked about the changes in nature and the spring, which is the mark of the new year for many people, which we tell them Happy New Year. And also, like the leaves of the tree, they fall in the autumn. These trees remake themselves with some new leaves, so you can do it to yourself as well and have some changes in your life. And that's it. Take a good care of yourself. Thank you for listening to us.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Limelight.
Joe Biden must end U.S. climate obstructionism, or else future generations will mark his leadership on climate in this time of great need as a complete and abject failure. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Adrienne Salazar and Kate Alexander Reuters. This article is published under the heading Biden's Climate Action Woefully Inadequate to Meet Escalating Crisis. Stay tuned for more. The Biden administration's rhetoric about confronting the climate crisis obscures a frightening reality. Joe Biden's policies are keeping Americans on a path to climate catastrophe. The latest report from the International Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, found that the climate crisis is happening faster and more intensely than predicted. We need urgent action instead. We have the Biden administration, some people, and an NGO said. The week after the UN climate conference COP26, Biden launched the largest oil and gas lease sale in the United States history of 80 million acres in the Gulf of Mexico. A federal court blocked the sale, citing the administration's failure to consider climate impacts. Climate investments in the Build Back Better Act are in a state of limbo, while Senator Manchin, a coal tycoon Democrat from West Virginia, holds the package hostage. As Greenpeace reports, the Biden administration's policies entrench the interests of the fossil fuel industry and prioritize profits over the survival of the planet and communities at the front line of climate catastrophe, with Black, brown, and indigenous communities and women and girls paying the highest price. Biden's climate rhetoric is undermined by the U.S. strong-arming developing nations who demand climate justice, while domestically, Biden pushes to expand fossil fuel extraction and fails to deliver on climate investments he promised throughout his campaign. As a historic emitter, the U.S. bears significant responsibility to provide funding for global adaptations to climate impacts. The IPCC reported a deep need in adaptation to confront climate risk and a large gap in adaptation funding. The World Resources Institute suggests that the U.S. should contribute 40-47% of the $100 billion annual fund that donor nations committed and failed to meet by 2020. Instead, the U.S. average annual contribution from 2016 to 2018 was around $7.6 billion. Corporate-friendly false solutions that the U.S. champions, including net zero emissions targets, carbon markets, and restrictions on coal, but not oil and natural gas, amount to carbon colonialism. Through carbon trading schemes, these programs let donor nations buy their way out of the crisis by shifting the burden of financing climate adaptation to already impacted global South nations, deepening climate inequality. The U.S. frames emissions goals around net zero targets. Why net and not net zero? Under net zero, business can continue as usual by offsetting emissions with activities elsewhere to remove emissions from atmosphere, like planting trees in Brazil to offset emissions in California. This approach allows companies to pay to pollute. It also places human beings at risk by enabling ongoing pollution of communities and land grabs for forest areas globally, including indigenous lands. Biden's ailing Build Back Better package includes subsidies for carbon capture and storage, CCS technology, that advances net zero emissions. A Government Accountability Office report recently found that subsidized CCS projects mostly failed and were a black hole for government funds. If every existing carbon capture and storage project under development were active today, they would mitigate only 2% of all greenhouse gas emissions. Relying on carbon capture to scrub carbon emissions to meet net zero targets is an expensive and insufficient false solution that harms vulnerable communities. The U.S. promotes carbon offsets domestically and globally. Carbon markets will expand net zero to the global marketplace, shifting the burden of climate adaptation from wealthy nations onto the global south. Article 9 of Paris Climate Agreement set up the creation of an international exchange where nations and corporations can trade emissions credits. In practice, this means corporations and wealthy nations with significant emissions can maintain business as usual if they buy emissions credits from low-emitting nations. This will exploit the low-emissions labor of indigenous women and girls in the global south as the backbone of supply in the global carbon market. This isn't a transfer of resources to enable climate adaptation in poor nations. It's forced extraction of natural resources and wealth from the global south to meet the political interests of wealthy nations and corporations. That is colonialism disguised as aid. The U.S. consistently scapegoats emerging economies to avoid confronting its historic responsibility for climate pollution. At COP26, wealthy nations committed to phasing out coal, a key resource for developing nations, but were unwilling to phase out oil, a resource for wealthy nations that has led to environmental degradation and exploitation, particularly impacting indigenous black and brown communities. Apologists for U.S. global climate policies blame the weakened language on coal from phase out to phase down in the Glasgow Climate Pact on India and China, but ignore that the exclusion of similar limitations on oil and gas is the result of U.S. interventions.
The U.S. must focus on its own emissions and historic responsibility for the climate crisis. The U.S. military alone is a bigger polluter than approximately 140 countries and is the world's largest institutional emitter of greenhouse gases. But since the Kyoto Protocol, military emissions have been exempt from these climate negotiations, a position the U.S. congressional delegation defended at COP26. Global South countries least responsible for the crisis are experiencing its most brutal effects, a result of historic inequalities. At COP26, vulnerable countries called for the creation of a loss and damage financing structure to address ongoing climate disasters. But the US, Australia, and the EU coerced climate vulnerable countries into compromising and blocked their central demand. This is not the climate leadership that Biden administration pledged. Ambitious action to prevent climate catastrophe is possible, but Biden isn't pursuing it. The Indigenous Environmental Network identified 10 executive actions Biden could take to confront the climate crisis, from rejecting new fossil fuel projects to stopping pipelines. Public Citizen reports the Biden administration has approved more onshore oil and gas drilling permits in its first year than the Trump administration approved in its first 3 years. And finally, Biden's hallmark climate investments in the Build Back Better Act are indefinitely stalled because the president has failed to confront Senator Joe Manchin, who single-handedly is blocking the largest investment in climate solutions like renewable energy, public transportation, and green housing in decades. From Biden, we have seen more of the America First strategy that blocks bold climate action for the world and equity and repair for the Global South. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called the latest IPCC report a damning indictment of failed climate leadership, and that in the face of accelerating climate chaos, delay means death. Joe Biden must end U.S. climate obstructionism, or else future generations will mark his leadership on climate in this time of great need as a complete and abject failure.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.